Okie dokie. So hi everyone, welcome to Insider Class. Today's online. We're up to this last class on approaching the Buddhist path, which is sort of a general overview. But we'll begin as we normally do by doing a short meditation. We'll take refuge together and generate the mind of enlightenment. Say a few prayers and then I'll get to the actual practice. You just get comfortable with the seat. We'll make sure your back is straight and shoulders are relaxed. Keep your eyes open or close them completely, whatever suits you. Once you feel comfortable in the seat, just let your body breathe itself. Now feel the body breathing itself. Just relax into that awareness. Imagine the floor beneath you is made of sapphire light, soft, smooth as the palm of a hand. The space above you is full of rainbows and offerings. And in the space in front of you, on the lion throne, on a cushion of lotus, sun and moon, sits Buddha Shakyamuni. He's surrounded by the assembly of bodhisattvas, Buddhas, deities, heroes, solitary conquerors, and so forth. Surrounding you are all sentient beings. Beside you on your left is your mother, beside you on the right is your father. Behind you are your family and closest friends. In front of you are difficult people. You're leading all of these people in the process of going for refuge. What you wish to do is to reveal your own Buddha nature and help others do the same. To think that you are fortunate to still be alive and to have the leisure and opportunity to attain your spiritual goals. So you have to act right away. Things do not exist as they seem to. But while things are not quite right, you do have a spiritual friend leading you in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones: Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And to make the offering of practice purely in front of them for the benefit of all sentient beings. See yourself as clear as the deity holding the vajra and bell. And in front of the Buddha and all the other enlightened beings, and in front of all sentient beings, say, "I go for refuge, as I am enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge, as I am enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge, as I am enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings." And from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. So negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your lifespan, your virtues, and your realizations are increased. You recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And you decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings in the four immeasurable states. And so you say, They all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. They all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. They all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. They all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the vice of attachment to friends and hope of truthfulness. Again, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down. They wash over yourself and all beings surrounding you, removing negative karma and obstructions, and increasing your lifespan, your virtues, and your realizations. So the next exhalation just relax a little more in that state of spaciousness. Then in front of the field for accumulating merit, say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, acts, and energy. I declare all my devotions, truth, and beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cycle existence and turn the wheel of dharma to living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So to remain clean to a purified state and the merits you've developed, imagine the body that you have, all of your enjoyments and all of your merits are utterly transformed into the land of the Buddha. We're going to offer this new pure land to the teacher and his entourage. And so we say, this ground, loaded with refuge, stirring flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four constants of Salamu. I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. We've released the offering, and the Buddha accepts it and he smiles at us with delight. And we look up into his eyes. And looking into the eyes of the Buddha, we find immense humility, kindness, and acceptance. And from the heart of the Buddha, rays of light go out, filling the 10 directions of space. All beings are purified and blessings are granted. We recollect the three principal aspects of the path. And the light rays return into the Buddha. All beings from the merit field dissolve into the Buddha. When it comes to the crown of your head, you can see descend, comes down through your body to rest at the level of your heart. So your mind and the mind of the Buddha become of a single nature. Within the nature, you can hear the mantra of the Buddha. And so you say, Veta Vare Maha Vare Sama Veta Vare Maha Vare Sama From your heart, rays of light fill the 10 directions of space. And every sentient being abiding within space is utterly transformed into the fully awakened state. I think it could accomplish the two purposes. When the light begins to withdraw from the 10 directions of space and it re-enters your heart, you can feel your body breathing itself. You can hear different sounds and know that there's a seat that you're sitting on. You realize that this meditation is one of imagination, and this process has imprinted the mind. But I think that the potential for full awakening is on your mind stream, and what you'll need to do is to complement it with finding yourself a teacher that you can trust, developing renunciation, bodhicitta, the correct view. Think that you want to do this. Not just for your own sake, for the sake of all beings. Then breathing in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. With your eyes flutter open. Bring your attention back to the screen or the screen you're in front of. So today we're going to look at three topics. In between each topic, we'll have a question and answer and meditation. First, we're going to look at positive states. So here we'll be looking at our ethics, what they are, how you can develop them, and why they're necessary. Then we'll look at meditation and really its role in transforming the mind. And lastly, we'll sort of put these two together. How can we apply our knowledge of ethics and the process of meditation and see how this can transform the mind? So our first question is, what are the fundamental ethical precepts in Tibetan Buddhism? And then how do they serve as a foundation for our development? So the bedrock of all development is ethical conduct. Now, when you first decide to become a Buddhist, you are introduced as, when you are a Buddhist, the major role is to act in accordance with the Buddha's teachings on karma, cause and effect. So if you've taken refuge, that's your job. That's what it means. I'm going to act in accordance with karma, cause and effect. Now you might ask, why? So the simple answer is you wish to put an end to your own suffering, and perhaps you might even want to become a Buddha and help others do the same. So probably it has to start off with this idea of non-harming. You're introduced to some, when you take refuge, you're introduced to some precepts. You decide like the precepts are, I won't kill, I won't steal, I won't engage in sexual misconduct, I won't take intoxicants, and I won't lie. And you are said, so you can take, which ones of these should you take? So of those five, what do you think is the most important?
No killing.
Yeah. So the lamas always say, take the one of no killing. Yeah. But if you have a real think about it, I reckon the one is no lying. Do you know why? If you think about it, you can say, well, no, I won't kill, but then you can kill with lying. I won't drink, I'll say. So each one of them, you can lie about it and do them all. So I don't know, but this is just what I'm thinking.
I've
And
never
I thought
thought of it
about that.
that
Yeah. So I thought, the one I should they say is one, just the one that you won't take. I won't take the one about lying. So imagine if you say, okay, then I can lie about all the rest and do them all. Anyway, that's just my way of thinking. Lamas always say, do the one of not killing. We can all restrain ourselves naturally from killing. Now, why do you think this is, why ethics is the bedrock? Why do you think it all starts right
because you have to practice your beliefs. It's no good just having a belief. You have to put it into practice.
there? Okay.
I don't.
Why?
So I don't think you can tame your mind, do proper meditation, if your ethics aren't calm
Yep, that's right. You're going to be able to develop the concentrated states that follow that you will need to, and so on. So I think it's something even more basic than that. So then when you take, say, so you've taken refuge. I want you to think first of all, okay, you've taken refuge. You're a Buddhist. Yeah, well, like I said, if you've taken refuge, you've committed yourself to work in harmony with the Buddhist teachings on cause and effect. Yeah? That's what it means. And you've taken refuge, that's your job. That's what you're doing. Ethics is part of cause and effect, isn't it? Okay. So what happens when you kill, steal, engage in sexual misconduct, drink and lie?
Bad things happen to you.
Yeah, that's basically right. And what it does is you're saying, I'm going to separate myself from suffering. But can you do all these things? You don't separate yourself from suffering. You create suffering for yourself. If you're saying, I want to become a Buddha, you're never ever going to become a Buddha while you engage in those actions, because they hurt you every time. Most times what happens is people focus outwardly on the harm they'll do others. But think about it, like you've committed yourself to free yourself from suffering. You harm yourself every time you harm someone.
It's like you're going against the algorithm of enlightenment.
Yeah, you cannot achieve your goal. You might say you want to achieve your goal, you never will. You work against yourself every time you kill, steal, engage in sexual misconduct, lie, idle speech, divisive speech, and so forth. You do any of those 10 behaviors, you're not going to get enlightened. So you harm yourself every time. So that's where it starts. It says, stop harming yourself. You want to become enlightened? You want to put an end to your own suffering? Then stop harming yourself. Don't do these things. Yeah, that's right. Every time you act, you put in place a cause for future suffering for yourself. So you work against your intentions, your motivations.
If that's the case, why would you choose not to do all five? Why would you go, oh, no, I don't give up?
Because you don't think it through. So I guess it's taken me a long time to work this out and then to say it to you. And unless somebody says it straight up like that. It's like I said, most of our goal, if you don't, you know, in Buddhism, you're looking inwards. You're looking about your own transformation, aren't you? We don't naturally do that. We look outwards. And we look outwards like when we harm others. We steal, we kill. We're always thinking about how we harm them. And we do. Most times that hurts people. It's not certain that it will, but most times it does. But what is certain is you'll hurt yourself. And so you work against your goal. So there's your foundation there. If you've taken this refuge and then you keep doing this stuff, you're never going to achieve your goal. The bedrock is first was like restraint. Stop harming yourself first of all. Get yourself in a place where, as Ian's pointed out, you can start actually using your mind to develop good qualities. So ethical conduct is, like I said, the bedrock and the cornerstone. It's the foundation of all of your anything else that will follow. If you want to create, like, you know, look at this. Three aspects. You've got renunciation. Well, you're obviously not creating renunciation. Every time you harm somebody, you're harming yourself. So you're putting in causes for suffering every time. That's not going to work. Bodhicitta, renunciation runs all the way through it. You're hurting others and you're hurting yourself, so that's not going to happen. You don't have a view, that's for sure. You had the view, you know everything dependently arose. So every time you did something out there, it comes back in here. So you don't have either any of those three principal aspects either. So just from that level there, it's like, well, everything comes from an ethical standpoint. So we have these, like I said, negative mental states drive the negative behaviors. So negative here, I don't know whether there's an actual term like that in the actual text. Negative, I mean, I think it's a new Western term that we use. And if you would ask, like, so why is the behavior negative? You said it actually works against your goals. You know, so you want to go forward, but you're not going forward. You're going backwards. That's what you'll say, negative. Well, I've got a goal, but I'm not getting anywhere closer to it. In fact, I'm getting further away from it. So the question is, so what can we like do about that? So in the what we call the lower scope, when we first come here, like we start to learn, right? We don't know about bodhicitta, we don't know about the mind of enlightenment. It'll be spoken to us. We don't know how to train it. It's not all that easy to do. So the first thing they tell you to do is just stop doing these behaviors. Just stop yourself doing it. So we do that. As we get better, we feel more invigorated. We're better. We're getting much better. Right? Now we can actually use the mind. So we're training ourselves in the small scope and the middling scope. These are the practices that will actually free us from what we call, you know, rebirth and cyclic existence. We're actually stopping the greater harms that we're doing to ourselves. That's very good. We know when we do that, we're also not harming others. So this is also good. We're introduced to the concept that everybody is just like us. And in fact, nobody wants to suffer. Everybody wants to be happy just like us. Most of them don't know how to do it. So we're asked to help them achieve the same goal that we're seeking. Now, from that perspective, we can actually use the negative mental states. So here we're looking more now at, we're moving towards the bodhicitta. So we're looking at basically like transforming all the negative states. The most, common way of talking about this is through the practice of compassion. So we try to use compassion to transform the negative emotions into altruism. Now again, this requires sort of a big view that has come about through study. Now this is, most of us, I'm sure it takes quite a long time before you can see like overarching, get a big view of what's going on in Buddhist practice. Most of us will find ourselves like we get stuck in parts of it. So most of us, we're engaged in Buddhist practice and we've got the natural view of an ignorant person thinking that things truly exist. It takes quite a bit of time to get your head around the idea that no, they don't exist in the way they appear to you. They dependently arise. And what's the major factor that we need to pay attention to and how they dependently arise? You go, my mind. My mind is determining my reality. So if you get that concept, you're getting really, you can see by that nothing truly exists because everything is dependent upon your mind. So if that's the case, when stuff happens to you, does it have any real meaning? Does it have any true meaning? That has to be no. The meaning is dependent, like all things are. So when stuff happens in your inner space, inside your emotions, does this mean that they're negative or positive? Yeah, it depends on you. Depends upon what you can do with it. If it's expressed in a way that harms, we call it negative. If it's expressed in a way that's positive, it's positive. So this is all leading up to this idea of bodhicitta, where you take all the harms that you experience and say, instead of getting rid of them, you say, good, this is great. Why is it great? Anyone? Does anyone have any idea? That's right. What's one of the major things you'd be learning from it? Yes, that's right. Okay, if you went back a little bit more to karma.
Oh, this is like that I'm suffering because of negative actions and everybody else is suffering like this too because of their negative actions.
Yeah, so like, this is the fruition of a past bad behavior I've done. It's come out like this. The pain, the suffering that I'm experiencing now is good. Why is it good?
It's over.
Because it's over. That's right. It's come to fruition. So as long as you don't get up more upset and strike out, obviously you create a new one. But if you can bear it, understanding your, and there's ways, different ways you can bear it, then it comes to an end. So it's not saying, in a way, all the crap that I experience. Now, of course, if you didn't have some sort of understanding of emptiness, you won't be able to do this for very long, and you'd say, I'm just kidding myself, right? But in fact, it is actually empty of any true existence. And the meaning of it is entirely up to you. And so you train yourself in this way of relating to harm. And like you say, so when we're harmed, we can say things like, it's not me being harmed, it's the self-cherishing. That's what's been harmed. This is, again, it's good. So you can always say good. So they can say it's good because the karma has come to an end. Oh, it's good because the mind of self-cherishing, the mind that's only been concerned about me, is being hurt here. Like, I have to pay attention here. It's like, for instance, when we're being hurt, it's usually, well, it's either us or we say it's somebody else doing it, isn't it? So suppose that somebody else does something that we don't like and we're being harmed, we're being hurt by this. Where we are now, most of us don't like it and we'll strike back or do something to stop them. But if we had enough knowledge of karma, cause and effect, and bodhicitta, we wouldn't, would we? We would go back and strike them, or harm them, or yell at them, or do anything negative, because we would know, I've just put a new cause for my future suffering in place for me. And in fact, it's only my self-cherishing thought that's been harmed here. So if you look at compassion, so basically, what is it? It's a mind, it's a mental state, it's many times it's an aspiration. It's like compassion is like the wish to put an end to suffering.
It's feeling for someone and then wanting to free them of their suffering.
Yeah. And so we have that feeling towards ourselves, don't we? Because we experience suffering and we want to put an end to it too. And so the way we normally try to put an end to it is to harm the thing that's harming us. But if we've been introduced to the Buddhist teachings, what's actually harming us?
Sure.
Yeah, so mental states, aren't they? These negative states we call negative mental states. And the major one being self-cherishing.
Well, it's two things. It's like they're harming and it's affecting us because of our self-cherishing. Can't just say it's just us.
Like if you
be,
you do remove yourself.
Well, there aren't any people hurting us, are
there? No, but you get an injury.
Yeah.
I mean, it's disturbing emotions all the way around, but there's still an injury. But it's like the injury sticks because of our self-cherishing and disturbing emotions.
Yeah, so the major things we're trying to work against here is the disturbing emotions, aren't they? But the whole Buddhist thing is about the mind. And so that's where we've got to be sort of focusing. So if we're trying to get into, like, in terms of compassion, we should be expressing it to ourselves, which we naturally do, but quite unskillfully. Mm-hmm. So we need to become more skilled. But how do we apply Self-compassion. Now, this is, not a need for self-compassion, just renunciation. And I've got to give up the causes that hurt me. I've got to stop hurting myself. So then so we stop killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, we stop the lying, we do all those things because they're the easiest. But then there's still the mind of attachment, there's still the mind of aversion. That's much harder. So we start practicing ethics, we start where it's easy. Start with the body, then go to the speech. So we don't create new causes for suffering. That will weaken the previous ones, previous causes. There we have to come to start working with the mind. And one of the minds that we have is that we don't want to be hurt. And we can go, yes. And now that same mind, remember, if everybody's the same as us, we should not, just as we don't want to hurt ourselves, we should also not want to hurt others. And again, you can just trace that back to the very foundation. That's where it is. You hurt someone, you hurt yourself. That's how it works. So when we learn to work with ourselves, one of the first things they talk about is like patience, being able to bear your inner suffering and not react badly, whereby you harm yourself again or you harm somebody else. So the way we normally harm ourselves is just through more repetitive thinking. Like, you can hurt yourself and then talk very badly to yourself. And so we harm ourselves again. And oftentimes when it's others, of course, our thoughts aren't hurting them, it's our speech or body that hurts them. So we've got to express compassion towards ourselves and compassion towards the other. And in the Bodhisattva way of working with things, with the mind of enlightenment, one of the ways that we do it is by accepting the harms and trying to use them. This is what's actually been harmed here is by self-cherishing. So we'll say that, we'll feel terrible because we'll feel hurt too. So it's not about that. It's not just because we say it's by self-cherishing being hurt. We'll feel terrible. But instead of going, we say to someone, it's a self-cherishing mind that's been hurt. So you can actually go, good. Yes, it hurts. It's a self-cherishing mind that's been hurt. Because if you say, like, it's me, where's this me? Who is this me? You start looking like that. This is one way, but it's like that's the wisdom aspect of it. When you go, that's me, you're okay. You've forgotten about the self-cherishing mind. Now you have to learn the wisdom. Now you apply the wisdom, the insight into looking, who is this person? That's her. Of course, you don't find such a person, so again, the whole thing falls apart. But here we're not sort of speaking so much on that wisdom side, we're just focusing on the ethical side, right? That's more method here.
River wants to know, can you explain self-cherishing using a different word?
What did I used to say?
Ego?
No, it's not ego. No, ego is a word.
Self-preoccupation.
Self-preoccupation. That's a good one, thank you, Ben. Yep, self-preoccupation, River. Yeah, neglecting others.
My precious.
So again, so when we're feeling where we are normally, and so we are hurt, right? But we're saying instead that it's like it's a self-cherishing mind that is being hurt. How is it being hurt? Who's sort of hurting it? Normally we go, well, it's somebody else. Somebody else has said something, and so I'm feeling hurt. Somebody else has said something, but instead of we go, it's the self-cherishing mind that is being hurt. Thank you. Because that's the whole goal of the Bodhisattva vehicle, is to harm the self-cherishing thought. There are 37 practices of Bodhisattvas, they're called the great thief, the butcher, They give it all these really negative names. So this is the mind that's been harboring since beginning this time. This mind and ego grasping, they're really closely related. This mind here supports the ignorance about yourself. So instead of looking at the other person with disgust or resentment, we should be looking at them with love. Like, thank you. I mean, that's the role of a teacher, isn't it? You know, this is why we're meant to look at our teachers like Buddhas and so forth. And so we only see the good part of them because they're going to tell us something. Right? They're going to point out all our faults. That's the role. And if we didn't look at them as like Buddhas, what do you think we'd do? That's right, get angry. Yeah, get out of here, mate.
But you know? I still think I'd say, thank you, but get out of my house.
But she doesn't say that to me.
Does it get easier? Because we've got that, but like saying thank you or something, I'm assuming if you practice that, it would actually be hard at first. That's hard to say.
Yeah, it all comes with practice. So this is the thing, like when you find you can't do it, this is the answer you come back to. I haven't trained. You know, you just look at it, you probably haven't. And that's the major difference between us and others who can do it. They've just trained. Yeah, well, I often call them beings in samsara childish. Right? You see these childish beings, that's like us, right? Compared to the enlightened, we're the childish beings. So just like you're a parent and then you have your child and they're behaving badly, well, you know, most, you don't have to give them a hiding or anything, do you? You just know they're children. They don't know what they're doing. You're pretty calm about it, helpful. You know they're suffering a great deal. You try and help them. It's the same here. It's the same idea. You try and help others. Yeah, you could be.
Or condoning it by or not condoning doing it. Anything.
Yeah, so then it's like, again, it's like, how do you, well, you could, if you see that is the case, and you think that is the case, yet again, then you have to respond without harming them. You can't respond with malice because it's going to hurt you, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the intention and the skill. Yeah. So it's a hard work.
You can't guarantee that you're not going to harm them. You can say it in the most loving, lovely way, but they can still get
they have a, but you're not harming them. That's not you harming them.
Uh-huh.
Right? What if your intention, if you have a good intention and you behave skillfully and they are harmed mentally, that's on them. There's nothing you can do about that. So, of course, so here we'll be talking about. So then we come, like I said, we'll be talking here about bodhicitta, the spine of enlightenment. So again, this is ethical conduct that forms a foundation for renunciation and for bodhicitta. In fact, ethics here elevates bodhicitta, or bodhicitta elevates ethics, and the bodhicitta elevates the ethics. Here's like the highest goal. Right? You're aiming really high here. Your ethics aims of, way ahead. So our practices of restraining from harm and helping others purifies the mind, gets the mind ready to have spontaneous mind of enlightenment, spontaneous bodhicitta. If you look at that, if you look at how this mind, spontaneous bodhicitta, comes about, you know, you're starting off with, first of all, you've got to cultivate equanimity. Then you've got to go, like all sentient beings, I've been my mother. You go through those seven stages of thinking, or you go through the five stages and do the equalizing exchange of self for others. So there's a lot of ethics in this. All of that is ethical behavior. So you've got love, compassion, they're ethics, that's ethical behavior. So the ethical conduct creates all the conditions for the mind of enlightenment to arise. Now, this is this quote. by his holiness the Dalai Lama. He says, develop ethical conduct as a natural expression of wisdom rather than following moral rules out of obligation or fear. But this is not the same thing. So this is a major difference between Buddhist ethics and ethics of nearly every other religion there is. The ethics are coming out of the wisdom.
Meaning reality.
Out of reality, your understanding of reality. You understand karmic cause and effect. That when you harm somebody, you harm yourself. Doesn't anybody tell you not to harm others? It's just because, oh my God, I don't like being hurt. Gee, what should I do? I guess I better not hurt anyone else. Because then I do, I hurt myself. There's this natural expression coming out of dependent arising. So ethical behavior emerges naturally from wisdom rather than being motivated by obligations or fears. Buddhist ethics is developmental, with practitioners evolving from conscious rule following to spontaneous moral action over time. Now, so let me come in. We're not familiar with emptiness or dependent arising, even though the teachers will talk to us about it. It takes years before you get your head around what that actually means to you. They say, you know, we are creating our own. They say you create your own suffering. You create your own happiness. So we hear it. Okay, what does that mean? Apply it. If you were to apply that, what does that mean? It would surely mean don't hurt anybody because you're going to hurt yourself. This is what comes out of the wisdom, dependent arising. Nearly any other religion that relies on creators, it comes top down. There are rules put down on you for you to behave in a certain way.
There's also an element of what His Holiness calls intelligent selfishness, in that if we don't want to suffer, we do have to look after those around us and our environment as well.
Ethical conduct, you know, creates the conditions for wisdom that Ian brought up before, which it does. Improves, and this improves ethical conduct further. So I think in one of the Lama Soul Kappas, I think it's three principal aspects of the prayer, three principal aspects of the path prayer. There's this part that talks about when you realize emptiness. What it gives you is it gives you great faith in cause and effect. Now, that doesn't mean external cause and effect, it means internal cause and effect. When you realize that all things are empty and dependent, you have to ask, what's my suffering dependent upon? Ah, it's dependent upon me creating harm. What's my happiness depend upon? Ah, we're creating virtue. Makes some ethical practice very easy.
Yeah, because no one's telling you you should do something.
No, it's just natural, it's proper thinking. Yes, Ross.
Yeah, it's probably
a good idea
not to say much. Just to be quiet.
Well, okay, so you restrain yourself from harming, but you don't create the virtue. So you want to be able to create virtue too. But that's where we begin in Buddhism. Yeah, like let's just calm right now, right? Yeah. So you see the other monks look at the ground, and they're not up there looking around like this, and they're very quiet, and they only talk about certain topics, right? And it's the same with us. Yeah, it does take, I think, years to be able to put all the parts that you hear about and learn over years coming to classes and sort of fit them together and then go, that means this. And then you can do it naturally. For most of the time, I think it's not like that. It takes quite a long time before it becomes sort of like natural. Okay, let's do our first meditation then. Get comfortable in your seat. Let the body breathe itself. and set an intention to cultivate ethical awareness as a foundation for benefiting all beings. Then recollect how your actions affect both your mental clarity and your connections with others. Ethical conduct is the foundation upon which all spiritual realizations can safely be built. Without this foundation, spiritual aspirations collapse under the weight of the afflictive emotions. Like water purifying the stained cloth to receive vibrant dyes, ethical conduct cleanses the mind of harmful tendencies, so that the brilliant colour of the mind of enlightenment can deeply penetrate our being. So how does ethical conduct prepare you for deeper spiritual insights? Well, first, it calms the mind. It reduces guilt and it builds a stable base for meditation to flourish. So is the ethical practice mainly about personal growth or is it about benefiting others? All, both work together. As you grow, you help others better. As you help others, you grow. So how can you transform negative emotions into positive states of mind? The first, you need to notice them without any harsh judgment. And then you practice their opposites. Love for anger, giving for greed, and so forth. So approach each interaction as an opportunity to practice ethical awareness. And through ethical conduct, you prepare the ground for renunciation, bodhicitta, and the view to flourish. Now breathing in deeply through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth. There was one time I remember Rabina saying that if karma took place straight away, it'd be very easy to be an ethical person and behave well.
Yes.
You know, you just crushed beetles and killed flies. Can you imagine doing that and it just happened to you? You just went, okay, I'll crush that cockroach or spray the cockroach, and you do it next to your gun, and you're flopping around on the floor. That'd be very easy to just go, you just wouldn't do it, is it? It's because it's great time span usually. And it's
polluting the planet now either if the results came straight away.
Okay, so now we're looking at how we can use meditation to transform the mind on the basis of ethics. So we transform the mind, so we are transforming ourselves through ethical conduct, and that helps with the gross afflictions. But those afflictions are very obvious to us, like anger, rage, attachment, when we just stop it. But if we want to get really deeper and get at the causes, then we have to apply meditation. So again, so this is why ethics is really useful, because without that basis, you can't really meditate. So you can't develop the mind to meditate. The fundamental meditation practices in Tibetan Buddhism are a union of shamatha, also called kamabhati, and vipassana, or special insight. So with vipassana, with kamabhati or shamatha, by being able to concentrate on virtuous objects, the negative or the non-virtuous can't arise. The mind can't engage with two dissimilar objects at the same time. It can only do one. Now, if you can concentrate your mind on a positive mental state, the negative can't come in. So that's useful, but you can't be in that state all the time, right? Nobody can. So you come out of it, then the afflictions have their chance to come back up again. Even though you could be weakening it by focusing on these positive mental states. To really uproot them, we need insight into their nature. So insight has got two aspects. One is what we might call mundane insight, and then supramundane insight. The supramundane insight is when you're actually looking into how do these phenomena exist. Well, we want deep insight into it. What we're looking for is their reality, the inherent existence that they seem to have, a true existence. We try to develop insight and look. And of course, they don't exist the way they appear, they're just not there. So seeing that gives us, again, a sense of release, and we can just concentrate, stay there, rest in the absence of the true existence, so that we don't grasp at them as if they were true. We have to do it over time. So normally what happens is you develop one and then you develop the other. Or you develop a bit here and a bit there, it's up and down like that. So I remember Rinpoche always saying, he teaches insight first. So you know how to look. And then by knowing how to look and looking and staying there, that's the concentration.
Sorry, those two levels of insight, was that supra and mundane or super?
Supra. Yeah. So with supra, you're looking at reality, you're trying to find the emptiness of the phenomena. The phenomena's lack of inherent existence. Others, it's like you're looking at its impermanence, its insubstantiality and so forth. Also finding its antidotes. So we try to replace these afflictive emotions with wisdom and compassion. There's a woman called Byron Katie. So she's got a technique that I really like because it's so simple. So whenever disturbing emotions arise, any type of thought related to emotions, she just goes straight away, you ask yourself, is it true? And then if you say, yeah, she's asking, are you sure it's true? So it gives you another thought. Then she has a thing, who would you be without that thought? And the last little thing, she's got the thought transformation thing. So that's her technique. Now, so this is a very useful technique. But you get plenty of techniques like that. The most important thing is to actually acknowledge that there's something going on here that is disturbing. Place your awareness on it in some way. I have to find this guy's name again. He's always, the stories often come up in the Tibetan tradition. So this guy used to be an armed robber before he became a monk. And he never used to practice like the other monks did. And they used to wonder, he never used to go along to pujas. He wouldn't be doing all the things the other monks did. And often he'd just sit there, he'd pull his robe over his head. And you just sit there and they go like, what on earth are you doing? And he says, well, I'm watching for the afflictions. When they appear, I take my sphere of awareness and I plunge it into these afflictions. When they're not there, I relax. So what he's getting at here is that when something comes up, like look at it directly, like, get at it, right? And it, they don't exist in the way they appear to us. When you don't look, they appear very real and harmful. We use language to describe them and all that sort of stuff. But if you turn around and just whack your gaze onto it, there's nothing to be seen there. So in Buddhism, it calls it Mahamudra and Dzogchen. That's what they're about. That's their major practice. They're looking at using insight of the mind and go, boom, just move on. And it just, there's nothing. It just falls apart every time. Yeah, just by looking at it, the parts, nothing actually appears. That phenomenon doesn't appear as it is. It's really simple. As soon as you do it, it works. It's like, wow.
Well, really, all you have to do is question it, because yeah, again, it's the momentum of just running along with it that
gets what's the name? Byron Katie does the question. There's lots of questions in the Buddhist technique and other, spiritual traditions too. That you can ask a question, or you can, the question is, I'll have a look myself. What did I see the other day? I had this one with a guy that said his whole question was, what is that? That's the question, what is that? Just even if you just ask it, isn't it? It's like, so what's really interesting about it, as soon as you ask it, you're already out of the loop. You know, and the thing.
Are you supposed to come up with an answer?
The answer is to be experienced, not to be articulated. You articulate, you're back again. You're language based, you're away from it. It's like the thing of it, trying to realize emptiness, right? You can talk about it as much as you like, that's not emptiness. But you can have an experience of it, and that's the actual thing. So here again, it's just this thing like, I want to actually experience like fully what this thing is. I want to know about it. So I'm going to have a look. So why is it, simply put, why is it you don't see them? They don't exist
inherently,
objectively. And yet when we don't look, that's exactly how they appear. Right? And so we're affected very strongly by them. But if you look, and this is again, we call this on Buddha, the path of seeing. I want to see this inherently existent self that's really there. No such self is seen. Because it doesn't exist objectively. The emotions, everything is the same. It's all like this. When you don't look, it always appears objective to you. We're always the subject, it's always there. You look, it's not there. It's really that simple. But when we remember to do a lot, that's another story. Yeah. So we were talking about purification. Of course, it's a gradual process. It takes a long time to purify the mind, usually. But today I was reading about another lama, a woman in the Dzogchen tradition. So what they do is they do this looking for just short moments of time. And of course, when you look, it's not there. And then you just rest and they're not there, then relax again. Then look again. So this is all these moments of seeing the absence all the time, and you're purifying the mind. But we'll talk about transformation or purity. Like I said, it's a gradual process, but what you're aiming for is complete purification of the mind. So this is, again, if I'm just thinking of that analogy of the dust on the mirror. The mirrors, the state of the mirror is always the same, right? It's the same with us. It's always, in one way, it's always being pure. But again, it's the conceptions. There's a lovely praise to the Buddha where the last line goes, So he says, not the same, not different, and free from conceptual elaboration. That's the natural state of us. Elaboration. Yeah, elaborations. But that's what this is, and free from fabrication. So the fabrication is not of inherent existence or objective reality, all those sort of things. Everything's been free of that ever since the very beginning. If you don't look, it doesn't look like that. So some simple practices. This is what we should be doing, right? Simple practices. Oftentimes, that gives us help with how we breathe. Like, just calm down. Do the really simple things first. Find ones you can do so you can actually, you know, like do it. If you're sort of comfortable and competent. Like, you know, there's so many different practices in the Buddha Dharma. Find one you can like and do. They often start with your breathing. It's really simple. Watch your breath. You won't be thinking. If you're thinking, you'll know you're thinking. You come back to your breath. Just get that neutral state first. Become familiar with it, then build on that the positive states. Again, from His Holiness, is by subduing the afflicted aspects of the mind, then our experience of the world itself is transformed. The essence of Buddhist practice revolves around the understanding that our experience of the world is not merely an objective reality, but is fundamentally shaped by the mind. This is the thing, you take the mind out, like, what can you say? Absolutely nothing. As soon as the mind is in, geez, everything was there, everything exists. Yeah. So the mind has got this shaping everything we experience. So we can have some impact on that, on the shapes, on our experience. So here's a very quick technique. This is focus on an opposite or incompatible thought. Now, so when you have something bad come up, what's its opposite?
Good.
That's right. Yeah. So you do that first. What's good? What's good?
People find often good. Do that with, you know, to try and remember all the things you're grateful for.
Yeah,
that's right. You're lucky about.
Yeah. That's a very simple technique. Right? Another one, think about or ponder on the perils and disadvantages of the thought. That's another one you can do. Third, ignore the thought and distract yourself from it. That's what we normally do, right? Go to the movies. Just go and do something. Put some music on. Go, walk, just go somewhere. Right? You change your mental state. Reflect on the removal or the stopping of the causes of the thought. That's a little bit more difficult, isn't it? You have to realize, why am I thinking this particular way? What's the cause of it? Often we'll look outside ourselves and then think that's the cause. But like I said, I've told you before, this experience I had with Miffy, one time he actually told me to put the rubbish out. I was really upset.
And he's never forgotten it.
No, I've never forgotten it.
I think
that's about
the kid.
Yeah,
this was such a revelation to me when I realised it's not her doing it to me. It's not her driving me nuts. And I always used to think it was. You know?
You'll never get over it.
No, it's like revelation to me. Oh my God, it can't be her. But yet I thought it's always was somebody else doing it to me. You know, you run that karma thing through and go, that's impossible. That's a big deal when it happens to you, you know?
Blessed by the rubbish.
Okay. Yeah.
Finally, our partners understood it as well.
This guy, I swear.
And also, you know, I've got to make an effort. It requires effort. Again, this is our next meditation. That's right. So you're comfortable in the seat. Let your shoulders drop. Let your body breathe itself. And bring your attention to your breathing. You're just trying to establish a calm awareness. So our practice cultivates both mental stability and insight into the empty and interdependent nature of reality. And through this approach, we can dissolve ignorance and replace the afflictive emotions with wisdom. It's like cleaning a dirty window. Meditation removes the mental obscurations until the mind's natural clarity shines through, revealing the world as it is, an empty appearance. So how do you think a daily meditation could transform your mental patterns? So regular practice creates space between the stimulus and the response. Strengthens a mindful choice. So why does ethical behavior lead to genuine happiness? The ethical actions align with our interconnected nature, reduces conflict, and it nurtures integrity. What do you think would happen if we practiced compassion regularly? So compassion expands connection. It reduces self-centeredness. And it activates brain regions associated with well-being. So perhaps you could spend 5 minutes during the day gradually incorporating reflection on interdependence. Then over time, the mind's inherent clarity will be revealed to you. And this allows wisdom to naturally flow. So now breathing in deeply. Exhaling. Keep your eyes wide open. So the next thing we're going to talk about is the question is, how can this concept of compassion or bodhicitta be practiced in everyday situations like workplace conflicts or difficulty with family relationships? Basically, the practice of bodhicitta is this way of transforming adversities into your path. This is what we're going to look for. Like, you know, most of us don't like adversity, which is a pity, because if we did, we'd be a lot stronger than what we are, if we actually liked facing adversity and were able to overcome it. So you know, any person who's really good at sports, good at anything, basically, it's not easy to be good at something, but you've got to go through a lot of crap. It's hard. And that crap is what we mean by adversity. If we're willing to do it, we will get better, we get stronger. So there's plenty of crap in the samsaric life. plenty of it, a lot of it inside your own head. But we can transform it all. Like it's just a change of mind. It's just a mind changing. This requires remembering what to do. So this is what mindfulness means, is remember, remember. So if you're trying to develop a mind of enlightenment, then adversity is good. If you meet it, it's not what to do with it. How can I use it in some skillful way? What might help you here is reading books, especially biographies of people who've gone through some great difficulties, or if you find people who've become champions of some sort of thing, Champions always go through difficulty. That's what makes them champions. And what I've often found is that the ways of their thinking can easily be moved across the Buddhist ways of thinking. You know, their thinking works. If it did not work, they would not be champions. It's as simple as that. So if you can grab it and go, wow, I could use that in my life, but for my spiritual progression. Really, all it has to do is make sense to you. At least that's what I've found for myself. If it makes sense and you go, wow, that's a great idea, you know, you sort of, okay. Then it just requires you to remember to do it when you meet well for some sort of difficulty. And so this, like, you know, you get these opportunities everywhere.
Eddie, we've been preparing for Geshe Sherib's visit, so there's a couple of people that are going to do the cooking and the housework, and so they're already really nervous. And so I've been trying to encourage them that this isn't normal nervousness. This is like, yeah, because it's a big deal looking after Geshe, and you want it to be good, and all of your perfectionism is going to come up, and self-cherishing and impatience and all of that, and it's supposed to. This is part of the process. It's not an ordinary process.
So what I'm reminded of here is this thing I know about neuroscience, right? When they do this, there's no difference when they do the measurements between nervousness and excitement,
anticipation.
None at all. When you just turn the word around, it's like, wow, that's a big difference, right? You say I'm really nervous, well, they'll get in the way.
Anxiety, here I come.
That's right. That's really hard. But if you say, wow, I'm really anticipating, it's different.
Yeah.
So you can find out it's a lot. You know, that's based on reality. It's factual.
But also to not think that it's something to be gotten rid of as well.
No, you don't need to get rid of it, like you say. It's
worth being nervous about.
Basically, we need to remember what to do. Unfortunately for us, yeah, when things go well, we don't remember. It's like, fine, you don't need to remember anything. We need stuff to go wrong. That's where you have to, that's where you really have to go deep. Do I have resources to call upon? But that's when you know. The fact is that same that anybody can practice the Dharma well while the sun is shining and their belly is full. It's easy. In fact, I would suggest probably most of us don't even do it. We think we're fine. But when the rubber hits the road, that's when you know. And in fact, one time I had a job at the hospital. I really loved it. I had a cleaning job, but it was so easy to apply everything I knew about Dharma there. It's like, man, it's a breeze, right? Because you're in the situation, isn't it? You know, it's like, you know, okay, so I'm cleaning. Well, you can just think about whatever you like. Right? Basically, if you're an ordinary person, you know nothing about cleaning. Maybe you just want to get your job done. In fact, the cleaner I was with had a little closet. We could sit in there and hide away from everybody. Come over here. So that's what we did, you know. But I had all these great thought transformation ideas that I memorized and had ideas, you know. So wherever I was polishing and shining, I'd be looking at this and running all these thoughts through my mind. I could see the patients on the bed. You could do it. Yeah, which was a heck of a lot easier than sitting in my room trying to imagine it all. Yeah, so our limited life will provide us with the opportunity that we just remember that we can do it and what to do. So again, if we remember that everything exists interdependently. There isn't any true existence in anything. This huge freedom opens up. And for my way, especially the freedom of the mind. How you think makes your reality. You know, Viktor Frankl, that we see our life has no meaning, but I've already drawn that conclusion. You said you give it meaning. Jesus, you think about that. The reality you create for yourself We are given life meaning. That's a, you know, you think about that. That's incredible to think about that. Unfortunately, for us, most of the time, our disturbing emotions give us a different meaning. They usurp meaning. So this is why I always think Rinpoche started off as intention is the most important thing. Everything depends upon your intention. This is what there's meaning. So he said, all sorts of meanings you can give to life. And what's one you're going to give? Because whatever you give, that's what you get back. That's interdependence. That's karma. Giving meaning is an activity. It's an action. And again, I love this from Ari Shantideva. The childish work for their own benefit. Thanks, Trumpy. Buddhas work for others. Just look at the difference between them. I think it's enough, isn't it? It's all there, really. I mean, you know, what Mr. Trump is doing at the moment, where everyone can see it all around the world and go, and what's been created here? This is the result of this type of thinking? Wow. Also, you know, I, me, mine. Maybe I'm good at this in a different way. I've seen that that's the source of suffering. There's another way. And here it is. And this is why the other way works, because of interdependence.
Well, they've done all those studies of where if you get a group of people and individually you interview them, and the ones that go me first and the rest of the group last end up losing. The ones that cooperate,
yeah,
everybody ends up winning.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, it's just, I mean, slightly counterintuitive, but.
Yeah, that's right. It is slightly counterintuitive. And the opposite way is being encouraged in our societies. You know, you get a place like this and we're saying, well, no, it doesn't really work. I mean, we've all been doing what Trump is doing, haven't we? We've always made ourselves first. You know, it's what's been encouraged. And yet here we are. At least we're here. So, because there's some other way of doing it. How do I do that? What do I need to do? Blah, blah, blah. So true happiness comes from cooperation, not accumulating for oneself. If we were to just treat other people as teachers rather than enemies or difficult people or whatever, this would also help us. Again, it just says interdependence, just changing the word. You know, like I said, we have our own teachers. In the Tantric Vehicle, it said, regard them as fully enlightened beings, Buddhas, whether they are or not. You say, there you go, there's interdependence again. You impute a label on them. Whether they are that or not, it's going to make a big difference to you. Just like when we impute negative names on people, whether they are or not, makes a big difference to us, doesn't it?
Eddie, with that, the thing with Trump, I read an article that a lot of his actions are, if you look at it psychologically, quite spiteful, mm-hmm. and spite where the other loses, but you lose. And then there are various political, you know, approaches where there's cooperation where both parties win. And we're just seeing it play out now on this huge scale.
Yeah, isn't it? That's right.
There's also his view of inherent science. He thinks America is inherently powerful. Doesn't realize the power comes from its interdependence with the rest of the world.
That's right. So did you read that story about the president of Mexico? put up the wall. There you go, interdependence. That's right, that's good. Okay, it's some 8:30. We'll leave this one. Meditation. Yeah, we know that. What's our takeaways? Start with your behavior, right? All of us, because it's the simplest one. None of us need to kill any human being, and we can do our best not to harm insects and animals. I'm sure none of us, we don't need to steal. I'm sure we're all reasonably well off. We don't have to steal anything from anybody. And probably none of us have to engage in sexual misconduct. If we have a partner, that's great. If we haven't, well, you can look for one, but don't steal somebody else's. And in fact, if people are having difficulties, and you know about it, but try and bring them together if that's what's the best thing to do. And if you don't know what to do, then just be quiet.
That's awesome.
Thanks,
Ross.
Thanks, Ross. That's fine. Create tech-free zones and times to restore your mental clarity, because we've got televisions, phones, everything is buzzing and happening, right? So it's very hard then to create mental clarity. And then when you run into difficult people, look at them as people who are helping you with Dharma. At least they can be, so you could say, oh, this is someone who's teaching me patience.
or how not to act.
Yeah, that's right. It's another simple one, isn't it? People behave badly, go, not for me, thanks. Okay, so coming up next time, so Miffy will be taking the next sort of class.
In 2 weeks' time. So this coming Wednesday, no class. The following Wednesday, Geshe Sherpa, part of his whole visit. And then after that, Discovering Buddhism, Introduction to Tantra.
3 weeks time.
Yeah.
3 weeks time? 2 weeks time.
Starts in April. Look at the April calendar.
Sorry, Dr. Fisher.
That's right.
Don't get me to count. 2 weeks, 3 weeks, it all depends.
So, folks online, I hope this has been useful to you and people here. Let's dedicate our time, the energy we put into engaging in the class, both for the long lives of our own teachers, and that all their wishes come true, that we attain enlightenment through studying these paths. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, that I quickly attain the state of a guru body, and lead all living beings without exception into their enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, by which you hear, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as the human beings remain, may our true remain to the star of sorrows of the world. The wish-making, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, truly and currently kind things in that sort, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And lastly, for Rinpoche's fifth return, in holding and spreading the Buddha's precious and complete teachings, the explanation and practice, you all the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, I make this request.